Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Hey everybody, welcome to another fantastic podcast. And today truly is a fantastic podcast because, Case, we are talking about one of the hottest topics in the automotive industry, reliability.
Yeah, it's at least something that we see in the comments a whole lot, something that's definitely an interest for a lot of people for obvious reasons. And we want to talk a little bit about reliability with older vehicles versus some of the newer stuff that's coming out, because I think that there's a lot of these newer vehicles that are so sophisticated, they have so many different systems in them. There's a lot of people out there that aren't necessarily confident in the reliability of new vehicles.
So let me kind of talk about where this concept came from. Last week, I did a video with some industry experts, Sofian Bey and Alex Dykes, long-term journalists. They've driven just about every new car in the market. And we talked about our least favorite trends. And then I went ahead and read the comments when that podcast went up. And the comments, I would say probably 9 out of 10 of them, were discussing vehicle reliability and how the worst trend is that new vehicles are too complex, there's too much going on, and they're less reliable than old vehicles. So I wanted to see if there was some truth to that. So I reached out to one of our longtime trusted mechanics, Toby. And Toby not only works on older cars and newer cars, he works on a certain category of cars, maybe not known for the reliability.
Well, funny enough, we bring Toby all kinds of vehicles that are not within this category, but that's more on us. He is a German car mechanic specifically. The shop that he works at is called German Auto. So we probably should bring him more German cars, although I don't know if that would necessarily be to his benefit.
Yeah, exactly. Good point, Case. But it's a great person to talk to. He's been doing this for years and years and years. He's worked on everything from old German cars. He owns old Toyotas to newer stuff. Sometimes you go in there, he's working on modern Toyotas. Sometimes he's working on...
He's got an old Cummins.
Yeah, the latest and greatest in Mercedes-Benz. And he sees firsthand more than anyone, are old cars better made and more reliable than new cars? And especially the tip of the iceberg, German cars, which are typically the most complicated of any car to work on. What is that like? So we're going to cut to that interview. Andre just talked to him, and we're going to come back and give some more context to this discussion.
Exactly, Tommy. That is the question that we keep getting at TFL Studios, TFL Car, TFL Truck. What's more reliable? Is it an older vehicle or is it the newer vehicle? And to get to the bottom of this, I'm here at German Auto, and our friend and longtime mechanic, Toby. Hey, Toby.
How's it going today? So,
hey, dude. We wanted to have just a little casual conversation because you see a lot of different types of vehicles.
I do.
I mean, you specialize in German stuff.
I specialize in all the German stuff, yeah. But I do a lot of everything. And I've been working on them for about 20 years now. So I've gotten to see my mix and match of everything.
So you don't work, this is not a dealership, right? So you don't work on like brand new stuff that kind of comes out.
Basically, you're going to not see the car for about 4 years approximately. Mainly because it's all, you know, dealer service, dealer warranties, and recalls.
And like after 3 years or maybe 4 years, like you said, those vehicles are generally out of warranty.
Out of warranty. Right? They're tired of getting the big expense from the dealer to do oil changes and small repairs.
All right. And that's kind of where you come in.
That's where I come in. Okay. I try to help them out, price point. And also, you know, tell them the real truth about the vehicle.
All right. Well, let's start with this Chevy.
Mm-hmm. This is a nice, beautiful old 1972 Chevy Chevelle.
So
SS.
So when this shows up, are you dreading the fact, or are you in love with this? I mean, would you prefer to work on something like this? or something new?
The thing about working on this is you have to use your brain when it comes to fixing things on it.
Okay.
And that actually is just because you cannot hook up your electronic device to tell you what's wrong.
Wait a minute, there's no OBD2?
Unfortunately, no OBD1.
No what? Zero? OBD0?
OBD Toby. And that's what you use to diagnose and repair them.
So you're basically using your knowledge and, you know, but this is a pretty common thing, right? It's an SS.
Well, you know, it's a big V8, so as long as you know how to work on a good old American motor, they're all very close to the same engine and all the same stuff you need to look out for and do.
So how many computers does this car have right here?
This one, I have not seen one computer in it yet. The only one it might have would be the electronic exhaust, which are electronic cutouts someone put in.
Okay.
So that's about the only electronic computer device that I've seen on this one.
But it's an enhancement, right?
It's an enhancement. It still has your electronics, and, you know, it's got some solenoids and relays and different stuff that you need any vehicle to operate.
Yeah.
But it's minimal, bare minimal.
Why is it here?
This one has a little bit of an oil leak, so... Okay. It's 1972,
well,
to be expected.
Well, everything will eventually have a leak, right?
After sitting long enough, you know, it's going to happen.
Alrighty, so you're not dreading this?
No.
You know, because you have the experience, you've seen, you work on trucks as well, right?
I feel like I could close my eyes with one of these old cars and just do it by braille. Yep, you feel them out.
Spark plugs.
Yeah. You know, your filing order, you plug. It's not that bad, actually.
Replace a seal, maybe an oil pan.
Then you can get in there on most of them. The access is there. Some of these big trucks I work on, I can climb in the engine bay and just take a little nap.
Can we show that?
We can climb in here, but it's going to be a little tight compared to a truck, but we'll check.
Oh, no, but I just want to show the comparison, right?
We'll just see what, you know, a big block looks like compared to a new Lego block.
How about the new Audi 3-liter? Can we compare them?
Oh, yeah. Yep. You're not going to see much that looks about the same, though, unfortunately.
Wow, this is gorgeous, actually.
So, you know, you can see someone's redone this vehicle and done a really good job overall and... You know, routed stuff, and it's got factory AC and a bunch of good options on it. You know, main reason it's here is just to tighten up a few things, make a few things work better, and fix some oil leaks.
So yeah. I see, like, big pipes for coolant, and, you know, here's your radiator. Big components, right? You can kind of identify them easily.
Even a guy like you can identify some of these big components.
I'm kind of a dummy.
Well, you're getting better at what I'm seeing here. You're telling me what I got. So I'm liking it. You know, like any car, you're going to see that.
Is this the compressor? Is
AC compressor? Very good. And, you know, your alternator.
Yes.
You got your water pump.
Yes.
You got your power steering down here.
Ooh.
So, you know, you're talking like bare bones. What do you need more than that?
Okay. You can swap out the filter. Bam.
Yep. Bam.
Okay.
No big trouble.
Wouldn't
take you 10 minutes.
All right. Well, let's look at something more modern, right?
Yeah. Let's, you know, go from here to something a little newer.
Let's close this down. I don't want a bird getting in there, you know?
You never do know in this neighborhood.
Yeah. I don't want to see a bird in there. So now, you said you see some vehicles that are about 4 years old, maybe.
I do.
Maybe sometimes sooner, right?
It just depends on sometimes sooner. And the only reason why I'd see one sooner usually is going to be a rodent chewing a wire or something to that effect. A lot of these dealers do not like repairing actual rodent chewed wires. They actually would sell you a whole new wiring harness.
Yeah.
For, you know, thousands and thousands.
For a lot of money.
Instead of a guy like me getting in there, finding the rodent chew, replacing the wire properly, you know, insulating it, doing whatever you can to get no chewing again.
Yeah, maybe.
So,
yeah.
That's basically the only time
I see. Don't coat it with butter, usually, right?
Usually, canned pepper, some people try, but I don't know if that even works.
Okay.
So this is going to be, you know, a little bit newer, as you can see. You know, a little more fancy. You see?
Okay, so this is this a supercharged motor?
This is.
You're
correct there, sir. Yes.
Because I see this pulley.
Yeah, so you can identify some new stuff on this one, huh? Yeah?
Kind of, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I used to be kind of a VW Audi fan.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm mostly just a truck guy.
So, for being a 2015, you know, much else you can see that you notice?
Well, I see injector or coils.
Ooh,
I can see some coils.
Those are coil packs, exactly.
They're red. I can see a dipstick, which is good.
That is a nice option.
Is this an oil filter here?
That would be the...
So it's top-mounted, which is
mount canister,
kind of nice,
cartridge.
Right?
Yep.
My air filter is over here. So this is also easy. I mean, how difficult is this?
Would you rather replace this air filter on this one or the Chevelle air filter?
Well, Chevelle was just in your face. It was easier.
All right. So, you know, you don't think your hands will fit down in there?
Oh, boy. Oh, yeah. I can't see.
Yeah, so that's just a little bit of my point of age of what we're looking at and, and the changes they've gone
through. But this engine is probably, I mean, that was labeled as 365 horsepower. This is not quite that much, but it's close, right?
These ones, I mean, they scoot along more than you need with that supercharger. They do really good, actually. And the problem I see with a lot of the newer makes like this is, as you see, plastic.
Okay.
Plastic. Plastic. Plastic.
Yeah.
Ooh, we do have aluminum because it's a supercharger.
Okay.
More plastic in the valve covers.
Okay.
So that's my big problem with the new vehicles is the plastic used is basically like one big Lego project that I did when I was little. And they put it on top of aluminum. So it's a mix between aluminum and plastic.
So what happens to plastic over time? I mean, heat cycles, cold, hot, cold, hot. They become brittle sometimes,
and
right?
And there comes your planned obsolescence.
Oh.
Yes. How long is that plastic going to last under that engine bay of heat cycling and driving over the pass? And
but is it planned obsolescence or an attempt to save weight, maybe make it a little bit more efficient?
Mm-hmm. It's going to be a little bit of everything in my, my opinion. Okay. You're going to be saving weight. You're going to be saving money because you're saving money making a piece out of plastic instead of aluminum or metal. And also, you know, you're trying to get efficiency, which all is weight.
Yeah.
So the more weight you can save, the better efficiency you can get. And, you know, basically you get that fuel economy. So that's basically where I'm at on these new ones.
Yeah, but like you said, but now we joked about OBD2 ports over there.
Yes.
This one has it.
Yes. Yes.
And it has how many computers, would you say? I mean, dozens probably, right?
Basically, a lot of these new ones I work on, you hook up to, and you can communicate with every computer. There's going to be anywhere from 40 on up to 70, 80 computers in some of them I work on.
Yeah.
And that is a lot of electronics to go bad.
Yeah.
If you think of one computer going bad, 70
of them? First
of
all, you have to find it, right? I mean, you can find it digitally on your scanner, but then what if you need to replace it? You have to physically find it, right?
And then once you replace it, you can't physically just plug it in and replace it. You
what
actually
happens?
Have to reprogram it to the vehicle to make it work properly. Otherwise, you'll have specific lights or specific, you know, issues with the vehicle that, you know, consumer
error codes or something else.
Exactly.
Okay.
So that's where it's gone to, is making it harder for guys like me to actually replace the electronic components, the computers and that, and actually get the customer out of your shop for a decent price.
Okay. So, I mean, the main question is, I guess, reliability, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's hard to judge that 72 Chevy over there because, you know, we don't know how many owners it's had or what kind of life it's led, right? It could have been a collectible that was stored for 45 years. We don't know. But what would you say? I mean, if you took a vehicle, 10-year-old vehicle versus like a 20-year-old vehicle, what do you see? Like as far as longevity, I guess.
Longevity, what I see, basically, I've been working on them for long enough to see enough of them and enough with mileage on them. I am not happy with anything past about 2005.
Okay.
After 2005 is when that plastic and planned obsolescence and, you know, let's build these cars to be better for the people, but not necessarily better for the wallet, is what I find.
Okay,
yep.
So 05-ish, you would
05-ish
say.
Is the beginning of, you know, all car manufacturers. Certain ones are a little better on up to about 10, you know, 15, but maybe Toyota, Lexus, but not much. In my opinion, they're all basically made to last 100,000 miles. After that, they want you to get a new one. So it's going to cost you, you know, 15, 20,000 to bring it back to life. Is it worth it?
But what about old ones? Like I used to, my friend Mr. Truck, I don't know if you've seen some of our videos, he would say, all right, my alternator is bad, like we saw on the old Chevy. I can come in myself, I can replace it really easily in the afternoon, I'm done.
On the side of the road, if you have to.
On the side of the road.
Big time.
And, you know, it may cost me some money, but it doesn't cost me a lot of downtime. And I would do that maybe every couple of years in the old days.
Yep, back then.
But now, an alternator could last 100,000 miles. Is that true or not?
They can.
Okay.
And they can last less, too. You never know what you're going to get.
Okay.
And it's all, you know, the crystal ball continues. You never know what you're going to get until you put the mileage on them. And, you know, a good vehicle is going to be one that you get, you know, anywhere around 80,000, 100,000 miles, and all you're doing is specific maintenance, oil changes, transmission fluid, tune-ups, stuff like that, which is normal on any vehicle. But if you start going above and beyond and replacing all sorts of problematic engine mounts and different parts, to me, it's not going to be worth it. It's better to take an older vehicle, say 1990s, early 2000s, put the $4,000 or $5,000 into it, bring it back to life, and you have everything you need. Most of them will, you know, at that age, you got all the amenities you need. Mm-hmm. Who needs, you know, enough amenities to go to the moon?
Right. I mean, we're talking about that. I mean,
got more buttons than I know what to do with myself, and I know my stuff.
So, and this, let's walk maybe to another vehicle out there. I remember Roman purchased at TFL Studios. We purchased the 1997 Tahoe.
Oh yeah.
Remember that red Tahoe?
Oh, that was a beauty.
Beauty.
How could I forget?
It was. My dad bought it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, my dad bought it now, so it's kind of in our family. Mm. I guess we could maybe walk to that Porsche.
Yeah.
And you saw it, right? And I think first you said amazing condition. Paint is great. It was always garaged. The interior is great.
For the age.
You complimented it.
Yes.
And then you asked me how many miles it had. And I told you 120,000.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, oh boy, I think that was your words.
Yep.
Because it was over 100,000 and you started to get worried.
Mm-hmm.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scott's Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scott's Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Reason being is a lot of people do not maintain them. So they drive them, I've noticed, they drive them to 100,000 miles and they try not to do the maintenance. They do as minimal as they can to keep it on the road, but they don't go above and beyond to actually keep up with it properly. You know, and a lot of these shops will sell them small stuff. They don't want to do the big stuff. You know, they want to make the money in and out. Mm-hmm. So some of these shops aren't giving people the service the car actually needs. They're just giving them the bare minimal.
Like a Band-Aid almost.
Exactly.
Right?
Just keeping them on the road. And
okay.
Sometimes that's all people can afford. So I do understand to a certain extent.
But now I'm sorry, that Tahoe is not here. We could show maybe a little bit of video of it. But that Tahoe has power windows, power locks. I think it has a CD player in there.
It's got the AC. It's got all the little stuff you
so
could ever
want.
So
what if that switch, the window switch goes bad, and it's a 97? Maybe it's out of production already.
That's highly doubtful.
Okay.
Because, number one, the GMs are very good about parts. And also, it's a 97. It's not a 72.
Okay.
So it's going to be available, you know. And there's enough of them made, you always could find a used
switch
if you had to.
It's a common vehicle.
Exactly.
All right.
Yeah. So
what's the story with this guy?
This baby is in repair, you know, needing some work like always, but
what year is this?
It's a 2009 Cayenne, and it's just the normal V8, so no turbo, none of that.
Okay.
You know, basically need some brake work and some tires and a little bit of love. Been sitting around a little bit, as you can see. She's a dust collector.
So you said no turbos. I think that's another huge question that a lot of our viewers and listeners have, is that it seems like a lot of new vehicles, pickup trucks and cars, are going to smaller displacement engines and turbochargers, and a lot of concern people have over turbos specifically. Mm-hmm. What have you been seeing?
From what I've been seeing is it's a mixed batch. Some of the new vehicles I've been working on, they do have turbo issues. Some BMWs, some Mercedes, a few different Audis. Some of them will have the known inherent issues. Most of the time it's higher mileage though, 60, 80,000, 100,000.
Okay.
So you expect that.
Okay.
A turbo is always being spun.
And it's always hot, right?
It's cooking hot.
Yeah.
So if you need a burrito warmed up, that's the place. Yep. So in my personal opinion, yes and no. You know, but also I do not believe a small displacement turbocharger engine belongs in a big car. You know, it's a big SUV. They're putting them in big SUVs, big pickup trucks.
Yeah.
They are getting the horsepower out of them nowadays, but they are having to work quite a bit extra to keep up with that, you know.
So it's basically, I mean, like you're saying, that engine is a little bit more stressed. Maybe not always, but often stressed because accelerating from a stop sign, maybe even pulling a trailer, right?
Exactly. So, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, it's one of those things that they are doing all this for fuel savings and also
emissions, probably.
Emissions-related stuff. Yeah. And that's just how they're getting all the horsepower, they've noticed, is the proper turbocharger. You know, if you put the proper turbocharger on a car and it spools up at the proper RPM, it will definitely do its job. And I believe I do like any car that's turbo.
Well, but
it's a mixed bag, though.
And I see a lot of like new engines, like for example, Stellantis and Ram now has a 3-liter straight six, very similar to BMW and you know Mercedes, the newer ones, and it is twin turbocharged, but it's so designed. Like looking at it, you know, they know the timing of each exhaust valve on each side, and they're all feeding into the turbocharger. The whole engine, it's not like an engine existed and then they bolted turbos to it later. It was all designed as a whole.
They engineer them properly nowadays. Yeah. When it comes to the motors, they do have all of that engineering down to a T, to airflow, combustion rate, everything, to the size of the turbo, to the fuel injectors they're using. Yeah. The only downfall I do not like about most of the new engines, for instance this one, direct fuel injection. They spray fuel.
Is this a 4.2 or what is the size of this?
That's a good question. Should we see?
Yeah.
This is a newer acquired gem here, so okay. You know.
So you mentioned fuel injectors, direct injection, right?
Yes.
Talk to me about this because I've heard many complaints about it as well.
So, in my complaints, all right, this is all my opinion again, but the direct fuel injection, it's great. When it works, it is a great, great engineering process. The problem with it, in my opinion, is such high pressure of fuel they have to get to spray the injectors. That can cause some issues. The main issue is going to be the carbon buildup. So it's not spraying fuel on the back of the valves no more. Mm-hmm. It's spraying it directly into the combustion chamber.
Yes.
So that is making the back of the valves build up with big carbon deposits, which will eventually lead to misfiring usually when it's cold first start in the morning. And a lot of these cars they take apart, you take the intakes off.
And you could see that build up?
Oh, big time. Yeah, you'll take a 1.5-inch port and neck it down to a 3/4-inch port. So it's not flowing its proper flow of air, you know, into the engine, and it's not going to have the power it should, not fuel economy, all of that. And you can put as much fuel injector cleaner as you want in it, and it might clean the injectors, but it's not going to clean that deposit off the back of the valve.
Because it's not spraying on it.
Exactly.
Right.
So that's my big quandary with it.
Yeah.
But if you get those issues fanned out, you're going to have a really good engine again.
But they were so proud of it. It states it right there in the very front.
Direct
fuel injection.
Well, you know.
Because they're probably chasing performance, right? Oh. Power, delivery, torque.
Oh, yeah.
And response, right?
And it's got a little bit of all of it. You know, if you drive one of these, a lot of people don't mind being behind the wheel, you know?
It's fun, right?
Oh, yeah.
But I see a lot of plastic.
As you see.
Plastic. It's not fantastic.
Well, it covers it all up, so it makes it look good. It's pleasing. To the eye.
Oh boy.
Yep.
So is this a mechanic special then?
This was a little fixer upper I picked up, you see. You know. $3,000 doesn't buy you much no more, let's put it that.
Was this $3,000?
It's hard to buy them cheap, but
okay.
I do my best.
Okay.
Yep.
So but you know, you're the expert, right?
Yeah.
So you could breathe some new life. Into this machine.
Breathe some new life into it, spend some time in my good labor on it, you know, and bring it back to what it should be, make it be happy again. And it's just money. Can't take it with you.
Right. So I want to, well, Porsche does this, Mobil 1, right? So they're partnering with an oil manufacturer in this case.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm also seeing in the industry is not just the engines and the fuel injection systems and the turbochargers and the design are getting better, the fluids are getting better too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they may be getting thinner. And we can actually show your oil
Dispenser.
But the design behind the oil is getting better.
Yes.
At least I'm told.
Yes. Chemicals are definitely changing inside this oil.
Additives? Yeah.
And additives.
Yeah.
You know, it's gone a long way compared to what it used to be. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And also, all these new motors with the turbos and all this high-performance stuff, it needs good oil to keep it cool.
Yeah.
Yep. So it's important to have good oil, and that's about the cheapest maintenance you could ever do to your vehicle is keep up on oil changes.
Yeah.
I tell people if you can't afford to change the oil, might as well start walking.
So what would you say? Because new vehicles also have oil like meters, you know, they tell you the life of your oil. Mm-hmm. Would you trust the computer meter, or would you keep your own schedule and kind of do that maybe annually or more frequently if you're using your vehicle a lot? Or what would you say?
I would say 100% I've never trusted a computer.
Okay.
I would trust that computer half the time.
Okay.
I would 100% of the time trust my mileage.
Okay.
Mileage based interval of an oil change.
What if you're not driving a lot?
Still should be changed once a year.
Okay.
Regardless.
Once a year.
Chemicals.
Because time
down.
Is also can be a detriment.
Exactly.
To it. Yeah.
And then again, if you have a turbocharged engine, supercharged engine, they heat up that oil a lot hotter than any other engine's gonna. So it's important to keep up with the oil changes and do them on time, and that'll save your turbo and your engine. So yeah, you want to check some oils out? I'll show you what they used to have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's take a look.
The only issue I have with the new vehicles is they claim, you know, all these new fluids are good. Don't get me wrong, but are they a lifetime fluid?
Uh-huh.
As in the transmission fluids, they've been telling you it's a lifetime
fluid.
What about
like gear fluid or transmission fluid, like you said?
It's getting better.
Or brake fluid, even.
It's same old with brake fluid. You got to flush that every year, every 2 years to stay up on it, but... You know, basically, I have some oil here on, you know, this is probably what you put in there back in your day, my man. See that? Back in your day, they would have used some of this. What do you got here? You got some multi-vis. Yeah,
wow.
Viscosity. You know,
yes.
Multi. So you got the 1030 or you got the 1040.
Uh-huh.
All climate. So I didn't have too many options,
well,
you can
I'm not
see.
That old.
Well,
I mean, okay.
Close.
I see
you
that.
Know. All right, maybe
this looks
senior.
like soup, like chicken soup.
Well, you know, if you had the right spout, you just pop it in there and funnel it in there.
Okay.
So that's what an old oil was like. So you can tell not too many options.
Okay.
That's what you got.
Okay.
Nowadays, you got more options than you can throw a bone at.
Yes.
We start off, we got a BMW twin power turbo oil down there.
Uh-huh. So specific blend
for
BMW. For
BMW from the dealer. I don't mess around. I buy every oil that belongs in the vehicle. That way they can't say I put the wrong oil in it.
Okay, you can say right there. It's,
came
you
from
can
the dealer,
see it.
Sorry,
see
yeah.
It.
And then, of course, we got a 55-gallon drum of the Mercedes oil. That's
there
specialty
you go.
Blend.
There you go.
And do not ask how much it is, a drum.
I'm not going to ask.
Don't like asking.
I'm not going to ask.
And then
what do you have here?
Over here we have a lot of German cars like a Castrol blend.
Okay.
So, you know, especially Audi Volkswagen. So we always have a 540, which is going to fit in most of them. You know, and it meets some of the BMW specs and Mercedes specs as well, if you had to.
Mm-hmm.
But I basically use them for the German Audi Volkswagens. And then, you know, you got a 520, which is fully synthetic, which is good for a lot of, like, Dodge Rams, different stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Anything, you know, a Jeep. 530, that's more what I use on some of the diesels in the Volkswagens. So, you know, the TDIs or any of that stuff likes a little bit of thin oil,
mm-hmm.
Just for the diesels. So, you know, you can see.
0W20.
Yep. So you can see there's a little bit of everything. They've actually, you know, the thin stuff is a lot of the new car is going to be thin oil.
I see a
word. Oh, hybrid. Yeah.
I see a word that says hybrid.
That means they're trying to suit everyone's needs nowadays.
So.
And then you got to
explain the two numbers just really quickly.
You have
the first number and the second number.
Yeah, so you have a Toyota oil here. This is basically for all your new Toyotas.
Okay.
It's thin as could be. So the first number in oil is going to be how thin or thick it is when it's cold.
Okay.
Second number, how thin or thick of viscosity when it's hot.
Mm-hmm.
So as you can tell, very thin and very thin.
And very thin.
So brand new Toyotas like their thin motor and their engines. Yeah. That's usually the way they build their motor. They have really tight tolerances, and they can do the thin oil, you know, and not burn it.
Yeah, and also there's less oil for kind of like all the pumps to go through because they're searching for efficiencies, right?
Exactly. They're you trying know? To – the less stuff spinning in an engine, the less
– Or the easier
resistance,
spinning. Yeah.
Less resistance on that baby spinning, the easier it's going to be and better fuel economy. And the longer it should last, the motor.
Yeah. And hopefully it's designed with correct additives, you know, to provide protections for all the spinning components, right?
Well, this is Japanese OEM technology, so it's got
to be good.
It's got to be.
It's got to be good.
It's good stuff. So that's just a little bit about the oil and what I see new to old. You know, say if I'm going to be doing an oil change on an old baby Chevelle like that, oh, no, you never want to use
synthetic. Are you going back to the cans?
No, not quite that bad. We get close. Usually we'll put a Rotella T in there. It's got a high zinc content, is why, and the zinc, a lot of these new oils don't have a zinc in it.
Right, but the older engines like
older
it,
Older engines like the zinc, good on the camshafts, you know, and same with, you know, some heavy-duty Cummins turbo diesel oil. You know,
oh, good.
You want to use the specialty
oil. I'll tell Case about it.
Yeah, it's endorsed by Cummins even. Yep.
That's sweet.
Yep. So that's
It's amazing
what I
how
use.
Many different unique oils and products that, exist.
And it's hard to keep up with them, I'll tell you the truth. Yeah. Because before I know it, they're coming out with another blend or another option or another, you know, vehicle with maybe, something new.
Or maybe high mileage blend. Maybe there is a cold temperature blend if you live in Canada or something like that.
Big time. And I can tell you the price on this stuff
is not cheap.
Has not gone down one bit, especially after COVID.
But it's gone up.
Oh, big time. Yeah, that barrel of oil sometimes goes down, but not the quart.
I just replaced the oil on my Chevy Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And I paid $95 for an oil change.
All right.
It's a 2.7 liter four-cylinder engine.
So are we talking 5 quarts of oil?
Kind of, yes.
Somewhere in that, 4 point something?
But plus labor. Yep, I didn't do it myself.
Yeah, filter, labor.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's affordable.
Yes or no, because I'm old enough, since you mentioned my age, I'm old enough to remember where I used to maybe not do it myself every time, but take it in somewhere and pay about $25 for an oil change.
Yes.
Or $30 for an oil change.
Yes, this
now
is true.
It's three times as much.
It's, you know, everything's inflated, you know?
Okay, so...
It's getting expensive.
Your preference would be, like you said, 05 or prior, or something slightly older that you can invest more money... a little bit of money into to bring back.
Time and money, bring it back. It's going to be more of a great machine for you in the long run. You're not going to have the, you know, the GPS and, you know, all this electronic
the
stuff.
The screens.
More stuff to break and more stuff to keep you busy while you're driving.
Yes.
The road and the steering wheel is supposed to keep you busy.
Yes. Pay attention.
And old car like that, you'll know.
It'll keep you busy.
It'll keep you busy.
With that big 454?
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
All right, Toby, I really appreciate
As always,
your time.
Thank you.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
All right, so from what I gather, talking to Andre after his discussion with Toby.
What do you gather?
I gather that Toby is skeptical, to put it lightly, about some of the longevity of modern features. And I do think that there is some truth in that. And let's kind of talk about our experience with vehicle reliability, because Case and I have both been doing this for a long time now. We both own old cars. We're big old car people.
Oh, yeah.
We drive new cars. And I also get to talk and work with folks that have been in this industry for decades and decades. And I often ask engineers, are new cars more reliable than old cars? And the general consensus, granted they are engineers working for big companies, is yes, they are more reliable. And the example I get given a lot is back in the 70s and 80s, the metallurgy, the tolerances, and the build quality meant that a typical American car, let's say from one of the big three or four actually at that era, would last maybe 50,000 miles before a rebuild, even though they were a lot less technologically advanced. What do you think of that, Case?
I think that that depends on the American car, because you look at vehicles like our Willys MB, that is how old now?
80.
80?
Yeah. 80 years
80
old.
80 years old, still running strong. That's a vehicle that is so simple that it would be hard for it to break down. But that's not to say that old school Jeeps didn't rust, because they absolutely did. And yeah, I think there is something to that. I think that the processes for manufacturing cars have gotten better. I think over the 100 plus years that we've been mass producing cars, we've learned how to do certain things better, even as far as longevity is concerned. In my mind, and this might be my own personal bias, but I think that there was, you know, decade after decade of general improvement, and then more recently you started getting to a point, and I say more recently as in like the last 20 to 30 maybe years, where cars have gotten a lot more electronics involved, which can be a little bit more finicky. So I think that there's a balance there. Maybe there's a sweet spot in our history for me.
Yeah, what's your sweet spot?
My sweet spot is typically going to be 80s and 90s, especially 90s. It's a lot of 90s vehicles drive mostly as well as a lot of modern cars.
Right.
Right. At least you can drive them on modern roads. Depends on the 90s cars, because there are bad 90s cars too. But that for me is a sweet spot of plenty drivable, decent enough features. You probably got central locking, probably have ABS and a passable stereo, but you're not quite into the era of screens. It's mostly the screens.
The screens are what?
A lot of buttons,
big,
too.
Big concern.
A lot of buttons, a lot of screens.
So you're probably wondering at this point, like, why don't we just tell you the data, right? Gosh darn it, new cars are less reliable or more reliable. The problem is reliability metrics are so hard to follow and quantify to give a true picture of the longevity of an automobile. And there are firms that try to specialize in this, right? J.D. Power, Consumer Reports. But even those large and established companies do come into fire from consumers that feel like, oh, well, their testing group is too small, or the cars they're looking at aren't old enough, right? Or you know, is there some bias that, you know, if you're going to receive one of these surveys, you're only going to fill it out if you've had a bad experience, right? Or a really good experience. Like, it's so tough to quantify reliability data. The things that we can talk about, as Case mentioned, are some kind of tactile or real engineering components that we know last a long time or maybe struggle to last a long time. Now, if we look at the car industry as a whole, Case is onto something, I think, with the Willys Jeep discussion that we talked about earlier. Like, we have a couple of Ford Model Ts, mm-hmm. which are 100 years old and 110 years old, and they are still running and driving and doing their thing, but it's also because there are 10 moving parts in a Model T. Yeah. And it's also worth noting that those 10 moving parts in Model T are bound to go wrong at one point or another. Yeah. You know, like, they used a really basic ignition coil system with these, they're called buzz boxes, and these little, they're trembler coils and these little wooden boxes. They're really great when they work, but they go wrong frequently. Is it hard to fix? No, it's super easy to fix, but you do have to stop and fix them. Cooling systems, right? I mean, there's the transmissions have cotton bands, and these are all things that are used and repairable, but how do you measure that from a reliability standpoint? Because they will go wrong. They all go wrong.
Yeah. As impressive as it is that our Model Ts are running 100 plus years later, they do break down.
All the time.
Yeah, we have broken down in both of our Model
times,
Ts many times. And it takes very little to get them going again. But to your point, how do you quantify that?
Right. And then, like, you look at, I think some people are going to say, well, probably the pinnacle of reliability might be like the 30s or 40s, right? Where maybe we got to a more modern ignition system with a points and a condenser, right? And but they still used a basic carburetor and very basic cooling systems. And they were low pressure. A lot of American cars, like in the 40s, 50s, 60s, whatever, used
low compression, yeah.
Low compression inline six-cylinder engines, which on paper should last a long time. In reality, though, rings will wear out, right? Valve guides will wear out. And those engines, they don't last as long as modern engines because the metallurgy and the composition just wasn't there. But that's the same thing. Like, is a 1960s car more reliable because you can fix it with a fork and a spoon, right? Or is it less reliable because it breaks more often, right? Or it won't last as long. So how do you quantify that?
Yeah, and it's tough too, because I think these days there are a lot more cars that will be able to go a couple hundred thousand miles than there would have been. Like, I wasn't around in the 30s, if you can't tell, but
I was, for the record,
okay.
I was around.
Perfect. So maybe you can tell me, a car back in the day, in the 30s, a 300,000 mile car?
Oh, not a thing.
Yeah. Whereas today,
right.
300,000 miles is a lot of miles. But my truck, my pickup truck's at 270,000 miles. My buddy's pickup truck, Vinny, his truck is at over 310,000 miles. It's not unheard of. It's not most vehicles, but it happens. I don't think that would have happened back in the day. That being said, the cars that are being produced right now, like, probably some of the most hoopla around these complex systems and impact on reliability seem to be in the Toyota community, because they've gone from very, very simple, admittedly dated powertrains
sure.
in the last crop of body-on-frame vehicles to now hybrid turbo powertrains in these newer vehicles that they're coming out with, like the Land Cruiser, Tacoma, the 4Runner. And that has a lot of people up in arms about reliability of those systems in the long term. So it's kind of tough to quantify, is that actually, you know, is that vehicle going to be running in 100 years with all the batteries and switches
probably
and screens?
Not.
And yeah, probably
but
not.
But is it going to go 250,000 miles? A lot more likely than a truck from the 70s, right? And I think this is a good example of my challenge with discussing reliability. So this is my Mercedes, my old Mercedes, 1982 300D turbo diesel, which a lot of people consider the most reliable car ever made. And there are plenty of examples of these cruising around as Moroccan taxi cabs with 1.5, 1.6, 2 million miles, or the equivalent of in kilometers, right? That is tremendous. I mean, it's amazing. And there, people will say, most reliable car ever made. Mercedes 300D turbo diesel, or 240D, or 220D, or whatever, right? The problem with these cars, and the truth that I experienced with these, is the engines and the drivelines are built like an oil tanker.
Beautifully, yeah.
They will go forever. It's everything else that will fail around the car.
That's like my truck, minus the transmission.
Exactly, there you go. Yeah. So, like, the door locks will fail because they're vacuum operated, and the transmission might not shift properly because it's vacuum operated, and the climate control panels are terrible. They have cold solder problems. I mean,
and if you get it wet, it'll be full of holes like Swiss cheese.
And that is the big one. Cases brings up a really good point. People say new cars aren't as reliable as old cars, but then old cars would rust ferociously.
Yeah.
And not to say new cars don't, but since we have modern rust-proofing techniques, body dipping, unibody dipping, galvanization, right?
Yep.
All of these things have greatly reduced how quickly cars simply rot away. And that's the problem with saying that this is the most reliable car ever made. Sure, that engine and the turbo diesel might go 500,000 miles before a rebuild, but if you live in anywhere in the world that uses a little bit of salt, you're not going to have rocker panels or floors in it after 10, 15 years of regular use.
Yeah, and it's, you know, if your motor is still running but your car splits in half, it's...
Does it count as a reliable car if it splits in half, right?
Yeah, and that is another thing too, that people's definitions of what is reliable are going to be different from one another. A lot of people equate reliability to repairability, which is fair as far as keeping a vehicle on the road and finding parts for it easily and swapping those parts easily. You know, there's a lot of different ways to quantify reliability, and what we're talking about right now is at least how we feel about this. It's fine if you disagree. If you
100%.
If you feel like a 70s or 60s or a 50s car will do 300,000 miles more easily than something that's 10 or 15 years old from today, then that's fine. You know, a lot of people typically run off of anecdotal experience, and sure. people's experiences are different. So not everybody is going to agree on this, but this is at least what we're seeing.
Yeah.
As a little disclaimer.
And Case brings up a good point about repairability, right? Obviously, a Model T is a very repairable thing, especially compared to a modern Ford.
Because it was designed to be.
It was designed to be because they, it was good. Yeah, 100%. The thing is, though, talking to some other mechanics, like we have a buddy that works at this Jeep dealer in our area, one of the largest Jeep dealers in the western part of the U.S. They have a huge volume, master tech, been doing it forever, a lot of years. And you know, we asked him, like, are the new cars easier to work on than the old cars? And one of the things that's interesting is, like, well, they may not be easier to work on, but a lot of things are a lot easier to diagnose, right?
Yeah.
Because ever since 95, 96 in the U.S., every new car sold has to be OBD2, onboard diagnostics. So a lot of the challenges that you would have had back in the day of sourcing out, well, why is this car not running properly? You plug a thing in and the car will be like, oh, in this case, it's an O2 sensor, or in this case, it's a mass airflow sensor, right? There's a lot of knowledge you can gain from some of these computerized systems. Of course, the flip side of that is there's so many computerized systems that more stuff can go wrong and it's a glitch. And
at the case's point, like, how do you find reliability? If you define reliability like a Mercedes from the 80s, then all it has to do is get you to your destination,
yeah.
right? If you define reliability as I want my car to last 25 years and not have a single sensor go wrong, right? And not have a single warning light.
Then the fewer sensors you have, the better.
The fewer sensors you have, the better, right?
Yeah.
So it's a very interesting discussion.
Well, and two, you know, keeping in mind that at least if you're trying to cover a lot of miles today, you're probably going to be better off buying something new than obviously an older vehicle. Like if you find the best 123 Mercedes that you can find, it's still going to be a 40-year-old car, roundabout, right?
Right.
So could you drive it a lot of miles and get by? For sure. But if you want to find a really nice 123 and put 200,000 miles on it over the next 4 years, you're probably going to have more issues than you would have if you bought a name any modern vehicle.
Right. No, and I think, like, let's talk about some things in modern vehicles that have a reputation for leading to problems down the road. So the big one that we're seeing in everything is turbocharging, right?
Sure.
Which really became prevalent in performance cars, at least in the 1980s, and kind of quickly gained a reputation for blowing engines up prematurely and creating more problems prematurely. Okay.
Tell you what.
Not your turbo diesels.
Okay, yeah, coming out of that world, if a turbo makes your engine weaker
yes.
and less reliable, you need a stronger engine.
You need a stronger engine. But let's take Case's turbo diesel Cummins out of the equation. Yeah. If you look at, like,
or 7.3s, the power strokes.
Yeah, or the 7.3 power strokes. But if you look at the consumer turbos, like the Audi turbos from the 1980s, right? They had a pretty high failure rate.
Yeah.
Even some of the Saab stuff, pretty high failure rate. And I was talking to an engineer lead recently. Like, why? What has changed? Why can you tell me that this modern turbocharged engine is going to last longer when a turbo from the 80s, which on paper is a lot simpler, would only do 60,000 miles before major failure? And he said it's because fundamentally modern engines from the get-go are designed with turbocharging in mind.
Yeah.
And what that means is they're intended from the get-go to be able, from a bottom end standpoint, to take boost, from a cooling standpoint, be able to cool its components properly, oil feed turbos instead of, you know, not cooling turbos properly. That's another big thing. Keeping everything yeah. cool.
They didn't just haphazardly
yeah, right.
add a turbo to an existing engine.
Keeping pressures in check. Talk about, like, NOx sensors, for example, right? And these are designed from the start to work as turbo engines, where a lot of the first turbos were just a typical four-cylinder that they bolted boost to, which led to problems.
Except for the 6BT.
Except for Case's Cummins, yeah, which is a turbo engine to start with. So I thought that was a really interesting response. Now, another thing, so I'm not as worried about modern turbocharging as some other things, right? A lot of the other problems, and we're just going to touch on this briefly, because it's a hot-button issue, but unfortunately, historically, this is not in my opinion, it's a fact, a lot of the emissions equipment we put on modern cars to keep them clean do have a tendency to create issues down the road. And I'll give you an example, an EGR system. You want to explain what that does and how that works?
Yeah, exhaust gas recirculation. So you're bringing some of that exhaust back to the front end of everything, back into the intake, which has obvious downsides. You're dirtying a lot of those components.
Right.
You're going to get extra carbon buildup. So you can go online and find some pretty gnarly examples of how gunked up things can get.
Right.
Yeah, so there's pros and cons there that we won't get super far into.
but it is something to keep in mind, right?
Yeah, for sure. It's an aspect. So one of the reasons that people who are in this world love the older pre-emissions diesels is because they are very simple and they are very robust, partly because they don't have those systems in place. And there's drawbacks to that too, but it does. Yeah, that's one of the things that can impact longevity. I feel like there's a lot of
things like that you could talk about.
Yeah. Like with the modern Toyotas and especially the hybrid models, a lot of people are concerned about those hybrid systems, the batteries, the electric motors, all this added complexity is going to make it a bad powertrain. But Toyota, to be fair, has been making hybrid systems for a while.
20 years. Over almost 25 years now. Early 2000s is when the Prius came to the U.S. And there was even a generation before it came to the U.S. in the 90s in Japan. And that's a good example where it's figured out. Yeah. You know, and I think that's the key in a lot of modern cars is like a technology will come out that will make the car less reliable. But then over the course of a year or 5 years or 10 years or 25 years, like Toyota, they figure out how to make it last a long time. Another good example of that, I think, is direct injection. You know, like a lot of the early direct injection cars from 20 years ago, let's say, would suffer from major carbon buildup problems on like intakes, right? That's a problem we are not so much seeing anymore. I mean, I'm not saying it's gone away completely, but there's ways that we can mitigate that now. And there's ways we can work around that. Turbocharging, another one where it came out, it was a pretty bad thing, right? Even automatic transmissions were terribly unreliable for a lot of years before we figured out torque converters and how to make them work really well, right? So I don't want to just say out of the box, like new technology is going to make the car less reliable. I think maybe initially, right? But new technology plus years of revisions makes it old technology, which makes it reliable.
And again, you know, tempering your expectations because just because a vehicle is naturally aspirated and it's got very few electronics doesn't mean it's going to be a 500,000 mile vehicle.
Well, like the naturally aspirated diesels that GM tried in the 80s, right?
Where they took the 6.2s.
Yeah, they took a gas V8 diesel, the gas Chevy 350, and they just made it a diesel, and it was a disaster. And on paper, it's a very simple mechanical injection thing. How could they mess that up? But just because something is naturally aspirated doesn't mean it's going to be good.
Yeah.
Like the Rover V8, you know?
Yeah. But at the same time, too, I think a lot of times people's fears about a thing being unreliable are worse than the reality of that reliability itself. Because in theory, everybody who's not driving an 80, 100 series or 200 series Land Cruiser should be having to be towed.
Stuck on the side of the road.
Yeah, every other day.
Right.
And the reality of it is just, you know, I mean, vehicles are complex machines and you could buy the best possible one that's supposed to be as reliable as anything on the road and it could still have an issue. I mean, you could buy the now outgoing 4Runner, which is known to be a very solid vehicle and they've been producing it for a really long time. And you could buy one of those and have something crazy out there happen. They're complex machines and stuff happens.
Yeah.
So there's no getting around that aspect of it. But I think that a lot of vehicles that people expect to be very unreliable can be a lot more reliable than they think they will be. And again, pulling from an anecdote here, so it's not everyone's experience, but one of my best buddies drives a Land Rover Discovery 2, which is known to be one of the least reliable cars you could possibly go buy. And his has over 220,000 miles. He does have to work on it. But the fact that someone, and now him, has driven that over 200,000 miles means it's been reliable enough to still use.
Right.
And I think that a lot of times stuff is not as bad as people expect. Like EVs, I think there was
good one.
A big stink early on, and I think there still is, about having to replace the battery on an EV after 10 years. And it's going to be tens of thousands of dollars. It will bankrupt you. And then you'll be living on the street. And all of your friends won't talk to you anymore. And
your wife will leave you.
Yeah, the worst thing that's ever happened to you. But that's now that we've been mass producing EVs for a while, and some of them are really getting up there in miles, that's kind of proving to not really be the case.
Yeah, and like there was a study that recently came out that looked at a huge percentage of Tesla products, right, that have been out since 2012 in the Model S, and they looked at like, I don't remember, thousands of cars, and something like 95% of all Teslas ever made, even those early cars, still have over 90% of their battery life remaining, right, and that doesn't go with the headline we saw when EVs first started hitting the mainstream, where you only get 3 years out of your battery before you need a $30,000 replacement, right?
Yeah.
And the problem is, like, there are certain cars where I think that was probably maybe not true, but not far off. Like, we always talk about on this podcast, the early Nissan Leaf, mm-hmm. right?
Air-cooled battery.
Nissan cut corners. They cut costs in developing battery on the Nissan Leaf people would fast charge them in Phoenix, Arizona. In the summer, the temperatures would spike, and guess what? Batteries would start failing in record rates. But that's not the same as something like a Model S battery or a BMW i3 battery, right, where they're climate controlling and the batteries are always at a constant temperature. Not to say they're not going to fail, but the percentage of failures we're seeing are just teeny, teeny, tiny, right, on those batteries.
Yeah, which just goes to show you can't equate one technology to being unreliable when there are a lot of different ways to engineer it. There are ways to engineer it such that the longevity is going to be poor, but there's probably also a way to engineer it that it won't be, which is the same thing that we were talking about before with turbocharged engines.
Right.
Have there been bad turbocharged
yes.
engines? Absolutely.
Right.
Does that mean that all turbo engines are bad? Not at all.
Or like, I wouldn't say that an Oldsmobile Sierra Cutlass diesel from 1984, right? That's a diesel engine, very unreliable. I can't look at that and be like, because that car is unreliable, every diesel is unreliable, right?
Yeah. No.
I can't say a 2010 Nissan Leaf has had a battery pack failure. Every EV is going to have a battery pack failure, right? It doesn't equate. Yeah. Doesn't work like that.
No.
You know? And I think that the EV thing, from a reliability standpoint, it gets so much media when a car catches on fire, which is such...
When an electric car catches
on fire. Yeah. Which is such a teeny, teeny, tiny percentage of all the cars they build. If we reported every time a gas car went on fire of a model, it would just
be our full-time job.
Full-time job reporting on yeah. gas car files, right? I mean, it's a tiny percentage. Granted, when they do catch on fire, it's a big deal putting them out. And, you know, there is it's a scary thing, right? It's a scary thing.
100%.
So I'm not saying it's not worth the headline. I'm just saying if we report on every gas car fire, we'd be out of a job. Or
we'd have a job.
Very much in a job.
Yeah, we'd never be wanting for employment.
But when you look at like the technology, especially where we're at with EVs now, there are so few moving parts. Going back to that Model T thing, right?
Yeah.
The reason Model Ts last 100 years is because they're made out of radium steel or whatever they called it, which is 25 inches thick. And there's 10 moving parts on that car, whatever it is. EVs genuinely have 10 moving parts in an entire drivetrain. There's just so much less to go wrong.
Yeah, and very little maintenance to do, which is great because probably most of the people listening to this podcast are more than average interested in cars.
Maybe.
Hopefully.
Allegedly.
Otherwise, you're probably bored out of your mind. But... For a lot of those people out there who aren't interested in cars, and we all know a handful, if not a couple handfuls of them, who don't do maintenance, don't do the regular maintenance on their cars, and they cheap out. And for those people, especially, the real lack of maintenance that you have to do on an EV, also fantastic.
Yep.
And yeah, so there are perks of different kinds of vehicles, depending on what your use case is. That should be obvious. There's a car out there for everybody. And yeah, a lot of these vehicles are just not as unreliable as I think people make them out to be. I think that there's this big stink that's made about reliability a lot of times where somebody will go out and they will buy a vehicle that is very dated, and a little expensive, especially for the features that it has, because it's a vehicle that's said to be very reliable. They'll buy it brand new, and then they'll sell it when it's got 75,000 miles.
Mm-hmm.
That's a little strange to me, because you've basically just taken that hit as far as features and just how nice a vehicle is to drive, so that the next person down the line or the person after that can have a reliable vehicle. I mean, most modern cars, and this was not the case way back in the day in the 70s, you could 100% buy a car brand new and it won't start next week.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
I had a grandpa that did that, yeah.
Yeah, and that's where a lot of these reputations, especially for like British cars, both of us love Land Rovers and we get all kinds of grief about it as if it were still the 1970s. Not to say that there's no remnants of that still exist at all, but it's not the 1970s anymore. If you go out and buy a brand new car, it's probably going to be fine.
And I think the last thing we'll finish on is what Case mentioned is modern cars are developed and manufactured to such a high tolerance. The warranties are so much longer than they've ever been throughout history, right? 100,000-mile warranty on like a Hyundai Kia is crazy. And what really... from the mechanics I talked to, if you want your car to last, just do maintenance, right? If you really want that engine to last, just do oil changes at the interval or maybe even before the recommended manufacturer interval, because some of these intervals are a little long for anecdotal, my opinion, right? And my final example I'll give is I was talking to, this is long ago, and I might get in trouble for saying this, but someone at Mini talked to me about the R56 generation, which was like 2007 through 2013. And they had a huge percentage of engine problems. Really high turbo failure rates, turbo lines would clog, and it was very expensive to fix these engines. And I asked him, I'm like, what happened? Like, how could you guys mess this up? And he said what happened was the engineers went to the final meetings and said these cars are going to require oil changes every 5,000 miles. And the marketing people said that's not good enough. The industry standards now is 12. So we're going to say every 10 to 12,000 miles these cars need oil changes. And the engineer said, we're going to have problems. And guess what? They had problems, right? And that's a bad example of a company failing its consumers. But it's a good example of how regular maintenance can save you a huge amount of money in the long term.
Yeah. And I think it's also worth another little disclaimer of Tommy and I, not only are we and our company here not paid by any of the auto manufacturers, we're not paid by big electrification.
No
big conspiracies going
on
here.
No big EV paying us here.
This has just been our personal experiences with vehicles, getting to work around them every day. This is how we feel. There's plenty of people out there that would disagree with us.
Sure.
And that's 100% fine.
And you will. We're ready to take the comments.
Yeah. And both of us love old school vehicles. So we're not saying that these old vehicles are all bad. I mean, we run the classics channels. Mm-hmm. We
love old cars.
We live and breathe old cars. 100%. And that's the majority of what we own.
100%.
But if both of us step back from our rose-colored lenses and take an objective look at things, even I, who there's for all the old hoopty stuff that I could buy and would and probably will, there's realistically not a brand new car that I have the money to spend on, or and there's plenty of brand new cars that I love, but I will always pick my old hoopties over them just because I love old hoopties. It's my personal preference. So if you love old cars, I'm with you. But looking at things objectively, new cars are better in most ways.
Guys, let us know what you think in the comments section below. As always, this has been Tommy.
And Case.
Head over to alltfl.com if you want to find more podcasts, or be sure to subscribe on wherever you get your podcast and YouTube as well. We'll see you next time. Thanks, folks.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off 2 or more select major appliances. Plus, get 3 Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9, selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.